This week, I was watching my daughter, and she was playing a particular video game. And if there's one thing that she's learned, as I've noticed, watching her play these games, is this. It's that if you encounter enemies, you know you're going in the right direction. If you're heading along and you're coming across all kinds of obstacles, if there's all kinds of things that are trying to prevent you from proceeding in a particular direction or beyond a particular door, you can be sure that's the right direction to take. You're headed in the right way if you are met with opposing force. There'll be obstacles. I think that was true for her, at least in these games. It's often true for believers. If you're going in the wrong direction, Satan isn't very concerned with trying to make sure that you have trouble. He's happy. You can go off and wander around and do your own thing all day. You're not going to bother him. But if you start pursuing godliness, if you start to worry about setting apart time to spend with the Lord in His Word or in prayer, if you're trying to love your neighbors, if you're trying to love your enemies, if you're trying to be patient with your spouse, if you're trying to be patient with your kids, if you're trying to serve the body of Christ, if you're trying to serve the community that you live in, well, you'll pretty quickly find that there are obstacles that will begin to appear in your path. It's true for us as believers. It's certainly been true for Nehemiah in this portion of the story. If you want to go ahead and turn there, we're going to be in Nehemiah chapter 6 today. In Nehemiah's experience, we've seen that from the moment that he left the comfort of the Persian court, well, problems have just been popping up left and right. He was immediately on Satan's radar. Okay, the enemy has been relentless in trying to stop his efforts to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And they're not ready to give up just yet. They've tried discouraging the people. They've tried threatening the people. There's been threats without. There's been threats within. And now we find they go after Nehemiah personally. So if you'll look at Nehemiah chapter 6, we're just going to start in the first verse today. Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 1. Now when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors or the gates, then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, "Come, let us meet together at Chephirim in the plain of Ono." But they were planning to harm me. A little over a month has passed. That's all the time that's gone by since Nehemiah has left Susa and gone to Jerusalem to take on this project. But despite that, despite the internal and external pressures that have been laid against him, in that little amount of time, he's managed to build up the walls. The walls that have been destroyed and torn down, that have been gone since the Babylonian Empire came in and wiped out Jerusalem and wiped out their temples. In just about 2 months' time, a little over a month right now where we're at, he's been able to raise up these walls. And now Israel's enemies have come to realize that Nehemiah is more than just a construction manager. He's more than just a clever foreman. He's a spiritual leader, and he has considerable influence over the people. They determine now that the only way that they're going to bring down this wall is if they bring down this leader. They need to take Nehemiah out. Then the people will be discouraged. Then the people will give up working on the wall. Then the building project will finally come to a cease. They can return to the status quo in the region. They can enjoy their dominance over the Jewish people in the region. Nothing like the fall of a leader to stop a movement. You know, you topple this leader, you topple the wall. And Satan knows that. He knows that if you can find someone who's been put in a place with responsibility, in a place of prominence, if you can attack that weak point, well, you can really multiply the damage that you cause. He's known that since Genesis 3 when he caused the fall of Adam. The fall of Adam is really what's put this whole world in such a bad state. It's because the leader fell. And then everything that he was over was judged. He's been practicing a lot through the ages too. I mean, I think of Saul. I think of David. I think of Solomon. He's gained experience and he knows just how to apply the pressure to secure maximum destruction. When you take responsibility to lead, you are putting a target on your back. That's why 1 Timothy 2 is going to tell us you have to pray for your leaders. Pray for those who are in authority. Why? Because they've made themselves a particular target of the enemy. And we love to watch a falling star. We just love it. That Adamic heart that is still beating inside us, for some reason, even when we know it's in our own peril, but it seems to take pleasure at watching somebody that we may have personally put on a pedestal fall down, as though somehow that makes us better by contrast. You know, well, I wouldn't have made that mistake. I wouldn't have made that decision. Here we find Nehemiah, and he's in a precarious situation. Sanballat and Geshem, two of those seeds of the serpent, really, that have been antagonists since Nehemiah has made it into Jerusalem, they come together and they come up with the Oh No plan. And the Oh No plan is simply this: lure Nehemiah outside of his security, take him outside of the city walls, get him away from his friends, get him away from his God, take him a full day's journey from Jerusalem. It's about the town of Oh No is about 25 miles away from Jerusalem. It's a day's journey. Get him outside into this neutral city that's placed over near Samaria, which is Sanballat's hometown. It's over near Ashdod. It's over near the borders of these cities of Israel's enemies, these territories that are hostile to Israel. Get him out there, and then, oh no, there's been an unfortunate accident, and regrettably, Nehemiah was killed. We're sorry. We couldn't prevent this. It just happened. It's an accident. It's nobody's fault, really. And they present it like a G4 summit. Say, Nehemiah, you finally made it. You know, we had our questions about what you were doing. Really, they present this like a concession speech. You know, it's a political speech that losers are coming to the table to make. They say, look, we got to admit it. We've been opposed to you guys and been opposed to the building of this wall since the very beginning. We didn't think it was going to work out, but really, look, against all odds, you proved us wrong. You did it, and you have made it. And now we concede we got to learn how to get along. We're going to have to learn how to work things out together since we're all obviously going to be leaders in the land. So pull up a seat at the table. Let's hit that reset button. Let's find a way to work together. Your team, our team, let's be friends. And I ask, is that even possible? Is there room for a reset button with Satan's team? You know, there's two teams on this story, been two teams from the beginning. There's the seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. And there's been hostility all the way through, because the seed of the serpent will persecute the seed of the woman. They will attack anyone that is related to Christ, anyone who places their faith and trust in God, and they're going to until that one comes who wipes out the serpent and wipes out his seed. So I ask, is this even possible? Can we just have a do-over and a reset? Oh no. There is no harmony between Satan's team and God's team. We are at enmity with one another. Less than a month ago, in fact, probably just a matter of days or weeks, these guys were trying to kill the children of Israel. But now that the walls are up, they say, well, maybe we can work this thing out. Maybe we can sit around civilized around a table and find a way to get along. Notice how Nehemiah responds. Verse 3. So I sent messengers to them, saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? Hey, did God send Nehemiah to Jerusalem to build up diplomatic relations? Did he send Nehemiah to Jerusalem to increase their trade or their profits? Did he send Nehemiah to Jerusalem to strengthen their hold over the region and their military might and their sway and political strength? No. He was sent to the region to accomplish one thing. Nehemiah had one purpose: put some stones on top of each other. He was sent to the region to rebuild this old broken down wall. He says, I'm not about to get distracted. I've got a purpose. I know what my calling is. I know what God desires for me. And I'm going to be one-minded about it. I'm going in and I'm accomplishing that thing. First and foremost, rebuild the walls. That's what was important and that's what he intends to do. There are all kinds of good things that he can do. Good things, things that we would say, yes, that's noble and desirable. But there's one thing that was necessary. He says, I'm not going to get distracted. He had two things really going for him. First, he's a man that has his priorities straight. He knows what he's supposed to be doing. He's got it down. Build a wall. I get it. And the opposition to the wall, the difficulties, you would think that it would make him second guess what he's doing. He's just putting blocks on top of each other. Is it really worth the trouble? I'm having a lot of resistance here. Doesn't that mean that maybe I'm not exactly going in the right direction? Maybe if I'm encountering trouble in my pursuit of serving God, maybe that's him saying this isn't right because it's supposed to go easy when you get on Jesus' team, right? Your problems are supposed to go away. You're supposed to be healed from sickness. You're supposed to be wealthy. Everything's going to go great for you as soon as you get on Jesus' team, right? Except for the fact that when you get on his team, you've made a very important enemy that has a very big hold over this world, who wants to cause trouble for you in everything that you do. Jesus says you will have problems in this world. They hated our king. Of course they're going to hate you who is associated with the king. If you associate yourself with Jesus, you will have problems. So Nehemiah doesn't see the resistance as a sign that he's not serving the Lord. He doesn't see the resistance as a sign that this pursuit of building up a little wall around Jerusalem is not worthy of his time, not worthy of his effort, not worthy of his perseverance. But secondly, he has this going for him. He's a man that knows how to say no. He knows how to say no. Okay? He wasn't going to let anything distract him from what he knew he was supposed to be doing. He wasn't going to major in the minors. He wasn't going to let secondary things divert his attention from the main thing, the one thing he was supposed to do. Each of those things are important. We need to know what we ought to be doing, what's, you know, the main thing for us, the important thing, the thing that God is calling us to do. For example, like Matthew 28, the Great Commission, the commission given to all those who follow Jesus to go out and make disciples. Go out and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. That's a necessary thing. That's a main thing. That's part of our DNA as believers, is we go and we share the good news of the King. A necessary thing. He understands what he ought to be doing. And he understands how to say no when things arise that are secondary that would divert him from that. That would take away his attention. Nehemiah knows that it matters where your life is spent. So that at the end of the day, at the end of your life, when your life has been spent, and you're looking back on how you use this time, this currency that you get, that is limited. You cannot increase it. You only have what the Lord has given you. So many seconds, so many moments, so many minutes, hours, days, weeks. It's been allotted for you. You got it in the bank. You might not know how much you got, but every day we're going in and we're making a withdrawal. And the question we got to ask, and it's the question that Nehemiah knows the answer to, is, am I spending it on the important thing? Or am I throwing it away on things that are secondary, that distract me from maybe what God wants to do in my life? Whatever that may be, because time is not a renewable resource. We know that we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works that were prepared beforehand. God has works prepared for you, good things for you to do, ways to serve Him. And we also know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12, that there are a variety of ministries, but one Lord. Translation: serving Jesus may not mean necessarily for you building a wall. That doesn't mean you have to do just what Nehemiah does. It means God has certain plans for you, certain ways He's gifted you, certain things He's prepared for you that is important and necessary for you to do. Things that might appear mundane to others. I don't know about you, but building a wall sounds pretty mundane to me. Putting stones on top of one another. I built a fence before and it wasn't very exciting. I didn't have Satan coming after me trying to keep me from building the fence. I wasn't having a good time digging post holes though. It may appear mundane, but there are work that God has prepared for you that is the necessary work, that is the good work. And we may be deceived by our enemy to think that these other things, these good things, are primary things. What is necessary? Nehemiah is a man who knows what's necessary, and he knows how to say no. Family is important. It's very tempting to let a lot of good things, even ministry, for example, come into your life to the point to where family, there's no longer any time for it, for example. Sharing the gospel, going out and doing all these religious activities is good. But if you're neglecting your kids, if the kids don't have time with their parents because you're too busy out serving other people's families, that's an example of how a good thing can remove a necessary thing in your life. We all have a ministry. You got a ministry at home. You got a ministry in these four walls. You got a ministry in this community. Know how to say no when it affects what's necessary. Interestingly, when Nehemiah sends them this message, when he says no, he says, look, guys, he doesn't just right out accuse them. He sees what their motives are behind it. He thinks he knows why they're asking him to come to this town called Oh No. He doesn't right out say, I know what you guys are doing. I see right through this plan and I'm not having it. No, he's courteous. He says, look, I'm busy. I have something that's important to do. Can't put it aside. It's necessary. So I don't have time to come out and play your little diplomatic games. Notice their counter. They don't counter by saying, okay, well then we'll come to you in Jerusalem. They're not going to take their meeting at Oh No with an answer of no. They won't take no for an answer. Look at verse 4. Now they sent messages to me four times in this manner, and I answered them in the same way. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a fifth time with an open letter in his hand. And in it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Gashmu, that's probably the same fellow as Geshem mentioned earlier, Gashmu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall. And you are to be their king, according to these reports. You have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you. A king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So, come now. Let us take counsel together. I was reading on a BBC website, and according to them, it was mid-2016, and BuzzFeed's media editor, Craig Silverman, noticed that there was a funny stream of completely made-up stories that seemed to originate from one small Eastern European town in Macedonia. There is at least 140 websites coming from this region that were peddling fantastic fictions and that were pulling in huge numbers of views on Facebook. And the young people in this town in Macedonia, the town's name was Valais, may or may not have had much interest in American politics. But because of the money that they stood to make via Facebook and via the advertising campaigns, the way that they could make money through views off ads, they wanted their fiction to travel as widely as possible on social media. And so, BBC writes that the Macedonians and other purveyors of fakery wrote stories with headlines such as Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president, and FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leaks found dead in apparent murder-suicide. They were, of course, completely false. And thus began the modern and internet-friendly life of the phrase that we know of as fake news. It was from this little 2016 Macedonian call, this little group of fellows that were purveying false stories. But I think that we know, while the term is relatively recent in the way that we're using it, there's nothing new about fake news. Okay, people have been adding spin, people have been adding slant and falsehood really as long as politics has been around. And fake news now in our story makes its way from Samaria to Jerusalem in the form of an open letter with the intention that it would be read, that rumors would spread, that gossip about it would spread in every town in between, and maybe ultimately make its way all the way back to Susa, back to King Artaxerxes. And Sanballat is, he's basically posting a message to Nehemiah's Facebook wall saying, look, rumor has it you plan to rebel against Persia and declare yourself a king. You think that once these walls are done, you'll be safe, you'll be strong, and you can fight the king, LOL. No doubt Artaxerxes is going to hear you. Is this true? Do you really think you're going to get away with this? Look, let's get together. We need to find a way to do this. We need to find a way to work this out to dispel these rumors. Hashtag damage control. Get together with me. Really, they're kind of blackmailing. They're trying to use force. They're going to make Nehemiah respond out of fear if they can. But even if he doesn't, sometimes an accusation is all it takes to ruin somebody's career. The damage is already done once the words come out. I think of the Me Too movement that's going on right now, which is a good movement that's brought a lot of much-needed attention to the underbelly of not just the movie industry, even in evangelicalism. It's hit everywhere, and it's great because it has provided an opportunity for victims to have a voice so that they can bring people like Harvey Weinstein, for example, to justice. They can be emboldened to say, look, this wasn't right. And I have the courage now to speak out because I'm not afraid that I'm going to lose my livelihood and be blackballed just because I was mistreated by this scumbag. But it's also had some casualties. Mainly because we live in an internet age of immediate information and immediate outrage. We don't always necessarily get everything straight before we move to socially lynch somebody on the internet and destroy their career. Sometimes an accusation is all it takes for a life to be ruined. Almost 40 years ago, Dr. Donald Campbell warned Christians should avoid becoming tools in Satan's hand by maligning and slandering one another. In such a situation, that damage is irrevocable. He's saying, get your facts straight first. Justice and only justice. It might be a hot topic today, but tomorrow when we're on to the next thing, these people are still picking up their lives. Justice for the victims. Support them. But at the same time, don't take everybody out immediately. Get the facts straight. A story is told of a peasant who slandered a friend, and later on he found out that the story was untrue. So he goes to the priest and he says, look, what do I need to do to make this right? And the priest offers him terms for penance. He says, look, you need to take this bag full of feathers. You need to go around the community and you need to lay a feather on each doorstep of the community. He says, okay, fair enough. He does it. Comes back to the priest, says, I've done what you asked me. Am I good now? The priest turns to him and sternly says, now go back and pick all the feathers up. He says, but I can't do that. The wind's already blown them away. They're irretrievable. He says, your words were irretrievable. That's the point. Easy to lay down a feather, hard to pick it back up. Easy to speak a word, easy to lay out an accusation, easy to ruin a life, especially on social media. Hard to fix it. You know, words are permanent, especially on cyberspace. So we need to be careful. Careful with how we're dealing with one another. You've received grace. Treat others like you would want to be treated. Treat them with the same resistance towards just immediately lashing out. So what should we do then? If we find, for example, that we have become the targets of fake news, if someone's spreading rumor or gossip about me, what do I do? I mean, the temptation, of course, for anybody involved in these situations would be to vigorously defend yourself at all costs. Look, I got to get out there. I got to plead my innocence. I got to demand that the charge be revoked. so that we become completely distracted with clearing our name, put everything on the side, I got to fix this verse. What should we do? How should we respond when we get involved with gossip or rumors or fake news? Well, first, we need to ask, is there any truth to it? Is anything that they're saying true? They're laying a charge against me. Is there some truth to it? And if so, we have to reckon with that. I think of Psalm 7. I'll turn there. You don't have to turn there. Psalm 7, David is dealing with this same problem, but he makes this statement. Psalm 7, verse 3, he says, O Lord my God, if I have done this, if there is injustice in my hands, if I have rewarded evil to my friend, or have plundered him who without cause was my adversary, let the enemy pursue my soul and overtake it. Let them trample my life down to the ground and lay my glory to the dust. He says, have I done it? Maybe what they're saying is right. But if not, he also considers, at the end of the psalm, he says, look, he travails with wickedness. He conceives mischief and brings forth falsehood. Verse 15, he's dug a pit, he's hollowed it out, and he's fallen into the hole which he's made. His mischief will return on his own head, and his violence will descend upon his own pate. He's saying, I do recognize that God's in control of these things. Justice is not necessarily meted out on this horizontal plane. Bad people get away with bad things, but not forever. And I trust, says David, the sovereign God, that this wicked one will ultimately fall in his own snare. God's going to sort it out. So first I say, we should ask the question, is there something true about what they're saying? Is there something I need to work on? Maybe there's a blind spot. Have I mistreated this person? Have I acted in any respect in regards to the way that I've been charged? And secondly, if not, notice what Nehemiah does. This is verse 8. Nehemiah says, I sent a message to him saying, such things that you are saying have not been done. You are inventing them in your own mind. Verse 9 says, for all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged and the work of it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. He turns to it, says it's not true, you're making it up, and he gets back to work. He's not dwelling on it. He entrusts his faithful Creator. I think of 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. Listen to this. 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter says, in verse 12, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. He says, if you're doing right and they are slandering you, don't worry about it. You keep doing good. Verse 15, for such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. You mean it can be the will of God for you to be falsely accused and falsely maligned and not vindicated until He returns, but shown in the light of day that all along you were just trying to serve the Lord and do right? Not that the evil would take place, but that the good would be revealed. Someone has once said, take care of your character and God will take care of your reputation. You worry about you. Nehemiah says it's not true. He said, you made it up. Now, Lord, strengthen my hands. What if Artaxerxes was persuaded to believe their accusations? What if the Persian king decided, better safe than sorry, came into town, wiped out the walls, wiped out Nehemiah? Nehemiah says, that's not my concern. He has no control over what the king believes or doesn't believe. He trusts God. Verse 9, he says, God, just strengthen my hands. Knees don't knock when you're kneeling on them. He just takes it to the Lord. The only one who is the clean judge. The only one who knows what's right. Now verse 10. Nehemiah says, when I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. And let us close the doors to the temple, for they're coming to kill you, and they're coming to kill you tonight. So there's a smear campaign. It's still underway. Nehemiah decides to make his way to the house of a prophet. Within the gates of Jerusalem, his own people, the prophet's panicked. He's got the windows boarded up. He's barricaded himself in, and we say, why? Well, he seems to think his life is in danger due to his proximity to Nehemiah. And he's had a vision. They're coming to kill you, Nehemiah, tonight. Thus saith the Lord. So let's go to the temple and barricade ourselves in there with God. Then we'll be safe if we go there. Now, a prophet's supposed to be a mouthpiece for the Lord, right? So when the prophet speaks something and he does a thus saith the Lord, to disobey the prophet is to disobey the Lord. But notice what Nehemiah says. He says, verse 11, should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And I ask, was he right? He's disobeying a prophet now. Was he right? Well, Nehemiah says, verse 12, I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. And I say, that's very interesting. How did he know? How could you tell a true prophet from a false prophet in Israel? How do I know when this priest comes up or this prophet comes up and says, look, the Lord told me to tell you this. How do I know if it's true or not? How do I know who to believe? Well, Nehemiah will tell us why he rejected the accounts. Verse 13, he says, he was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they may have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. He says, look, there are two problems with your prophecy. The first problem is that I don't think God has sent me here to build up these walls and to protect the people. You're telling me to do the opposite. That's a problem. Is he saying something different to you than he's saying to me? Are you talking to the same fellow that I've been talking to? But secondly, notice, no true prophet is going to ask someone to violate God's law. The prophet, his prophecies had to be 100% true. Namely here, he's saying, look, they're coming to kill us tonight. But two, it has to agree with everything that was ever said in God's word before it. Now listen to this. This is Numbers 18. Numbers 18, verse 7, in giving instructions to how the Levites and the priests are to conduct themselves, he says to the Levites, you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood. This is Numbers 18, 7. For everything concerning the altar and inside the veil, and you're to perform service. I'm giving you the priesthood as a bestowed service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. He says, well, that's very interesting that you are so worried about my life that you're trying to get me to go do something that's going to cause a death sentence for me. How interesting, prophet of God. We've seen it before with Balaam. You remember, Balaam couldn't offer a curse on God's people, so what did he do? We'll get the people to curse themselves. And he gets the Moabite women to go mess with the people, and God judges the people. So what Satan does at the beginning is a serpent. He doesn't come in and wipe out Adam and Eve. He gets God to wipe out Adam and Eve. He gets God's people to be at odds with God and His Word so that God has to judge His own people. Nehemiah says, not doing it. Not falling for that one. Satan's team. So of course, Deuteronomy 13 would say the judgment should be death for the prophet. Nehemiah, not being a priest, has no right to enter in. And he refuses to do it. He finishes the walls, we find, with this. Verse 14, he pronounces a curse on Tobiah, on Sanballat. Again, he's asking God, when we see that term, remember, he says, remember me, O my God. is repeated again and again in Nehemiah's prayers. Remembrance isn't acting, saying as though God has forgotten Nehemiah. He's saying, I want you to take up action on my account. Like when we observe communion, we are proclaiming covenant renewal. Do this in remembrance of me. Act in remembrance of me. It's kind of like paying your rent every month or paying your car payment. That's a car loan. I have an agreement with the bank to come and I'm going to pay each month on this car loan. And so long as I do it, I get to use the car. And one day, I'm going to have paid up my loan and own the car in full. I'm coming and I'm remembering our agreement once a month. He's saying, remember me. Act in accordance with me. It's like when the flood was on the earth and God remembered Noah. He acts in accordance with covenant faithfulness. Nehemiah is saying, remember me. And remember these seeds of Satan, really, the works of theirs, and the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who are trying to frighten me. So the wall is completed on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. Now, even though the walls are up, he gives a little postscript to let us know the dangers lingered on. Yes, Sanballat stuck outside, but Tobiah has made it inside through marriage. Through making agreements that offer money to the people, to the nobles on the inside. He says, verse 17, in those days many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came from them, for many in Judah were bound by oath to him, because he was the son-in-law of Shekinah, the son of Arah, and the son of Jehonan, and married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Moreover, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence, and reported my words to him. And then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So the nobles are trying to play both sides now. The walls are up. Nehemiah is safe. But they're traitors. And it's going to cause a problem for the remainder of the story. So I look at this. I look at Nehemiah's vigilance in the midst of enemy territory. And I ask, what about us? And what can we learn from this portion of God's Word? Like Nehemiah, we live in enemy territory. Like Nehemiah, the present war effort goes on. It reminds me of World War II. It reminds me of our country in World War II. Everybody participated. Not everybody had boots on the ground in Europe, but everybody was involved. Everybody had something that was necessary that they were doing to contribute. I think of the dangers that also didn't just stick in Europe. There were dangers coming from our country for the people with boots on the ground. Loose lips sink ships. You know some information, you pass it along, you can cause trouble for your brother and sister. A careless word can destroy a platoon. I think of the sacrifices made. I think of the people not just foregoing certain food items, not just foregoing using gas, foregoing how they're spending their time and who they're spending their time with. Going to work to provide for the people in the war effort. A war goes on. We're serving one another in a company in the midst of enemy territory. And you've got a job to do. And you've been specially crafted to do it. It's a necessary thing. But are we letting the minor things and the distractions of the enemies divert us from the war effort? Or are we learning to say no, like Nehemiah? To keep the primary thing primary. To major in the majors and be willing to say no to the distractions.